If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Dr. Squatch. When your personal care routine needs a refresh, Dr. Squatch is here to help. They have high-performing natural products with no harmful ingredients that'll have you looking and smelling your best. Like the Bay Rum Soap and Deodorant. It smells delightfully spicy. And right now, they have an amazing offer for new customers. Get 20% off your first purchase of any amount or a subscription order by going to drsquatch.com/Spotify or use the code Spotify at checkout.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Three great words. Free fries Friday. Especially when they're used in that exact order. Get a free medium fries with $1 minimum purchase.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Valid one time on Fridays at participating McDonald's through 12/31/24. Excludes tax, must update rewards.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. More than a year in, the war between Russia and Ukraine has resulted in tens of thousands of deaths, with repercussions on an international scale. It also continues to evoke parallels with a whole range of historical events, from the revolutions of 1917 to the breakup of the USSR in the early 1990s. Historian Serhii Plokhii has written a new account of the war, which sets it in this longer context. And he spoke to Matt Elton about the ways in which history can help us make sense of current events.
So, Serhii, we've talked a few times in the past about previous books you've written, but I wondered whether, due to the fact that this new book you've written covers events that are still unfolding and events to which you have a personal connection, whether this project was particularly tricky or challenging?
Yes, certainly it was. And I am a little bit anxious and nervous to see how the book on contemporary developments by a historian will be received. It started with basically me deciding that I can't do this project because it was emotionally so charging, so difficult. Also because we historians, we write about the things and developments that to a degree are completed. We know the answer, what happened, and that gives us wisdom, that gives us perspective. And here you write about something that unfolds in front of your eyes. So it is challenging. And another thing is that you try to figure out what is important, what is not in the news that came today or came yesterday. What will be important 1 year from now, let's say when the book is out. And it was new situation for me. Before that, writing on the 17th century or even on Chernobyl, you knew what was important and what was not. Here you had to engage in some form of, not exactly guesswork, but use your judgment and your instincts as a historian.
During what period were you writing this book? What present day events does it cover?
The book was written between March, so I really decided or convinced myself or allowed to be convinced that I can do this book. I started in late March. And really, the latest developments that are there come from February. So it really covers the first year the 1 year of the war.
So March 2022 up until this, yes, this February,
up until February, late February of 23.
And it obviously also spends a bit of time putting the unfolding conflict into a wider and longer historical context. I thought we could talk about that angle of things first and then move on to talk about some of the ways in which history is manifesting in the present. What are the origin stories, do you think, of Russia that have fed into the current conflict? And at what point did they become so central to Russia's psyche?
History, in a matter of ways, written all over this war, starting with the way how it was presented, justified, legitimized by the Russian President Vladimir Putin. The war very often is called Putin's war. It's, of course, much more than that. But Putin's personal role, responsibility for what is going on, is very big and very important. And I don't remember from my experience reading or about any other war where the history was used to such a degree to justify the war. So there was an article by Putin on the historical unity of Russians and Ukrainians that was published in the summer of 21, a few months before the start of the war. His speeches on the eve of the war were dubbed by some history lectures. So there was a lot of history there, and history in Putin's interpretation and the argument that he was making was going all the way back to medieval times, to the Kievan Rus, to legendary common origins of Russians and Ukrainians, and he was then going through the entire period, starting with the 10th or 11th century, all the way into the 21st century. What that meant also that for me, writing this book, it was important to start with the myth of origins of Russia that links Russia to Kiev, that explains why monument to Prince Volodymyr, or Prince Vladimir, who is a namesake of Vladimir Putin, was built in the very center, in the heart of Moscow in 2015, when Prince Volodymyr was really the Prince of Kiev and ruled in Kiev, and what did that mean? So my first chapter really talks about deep history of not so much of the conflict, but of the Russian-Ukrainian relations, mythology that is associated with that. And for me, that history was important not just as a way to say, okay, that's a misuse of history on the part of Putin, or this is right, or this is wrong, or this is what happened. But I also look at this war as one of many wars that were happening in the 20th century about the disintegration of the empires, the rise of national states. And in that sense, the history of the Russian Empire and the sort of the tropes, the ideas that existed there, and that Putin now is trying to bring back into the 21st century, are also very important for me from that point of view. So again, there is a lot of history, especially in the first chapter, and that history is there for a reason. One reason is that it's history that is being used by Putin to justify the aggression. Another one is that understanding the relationship between Russians and Ukrainians, the Russian imperial project and Ukrainian national project, is also important for understanding of today's war.
And it's very important, I think, to foreground the Ukrainian national project just as much as Putin's distortions of history. Is there a historical moment to which we can trace the beginnings of the Ukrainian national project?
Ukrainians claim as the beginning of Ukrainian history, Kievan Rus, medieval principality that was created in the 10th century. After all, the capital of Ukraine is in Kiev today. But if you talk about modern nation, the Ukrainian national, modern national project comes from the same roughly period where the national projects of most of Ukraine's neighbor, East European countries, are coming from. So this is 19th century. This is the idea of Ukraine as part not of the Russian Empire, but as part of the Slavic Federation of Nations. a very important part of that. So it's the time when the language, culture, history, and politics all come together in the mind of the thinkers, historians, people who collect folklore. So it is very European story from that point of view.
You write in the book that not until the 19th century did the Russian Empire encounter an enemy that it could not defeat, and the name of that enemy was nationalism. Is Ukrainian nationalism a key factor in understanding the ways in which Russia realized that it couldn't always succeed?
Yes, I would say that indeed the encounter with the Ukrainian nationalism in particular became the most challenging encounter for Russian imperialism and for Russian nationalism as well. The biggest troublemaker until the revolution of 1917 were the Poles. And they left in the middle of World War I and then the revolution that followed it. And the Ukrainians really replaced Poles as the most difficult national projects that the empire that was reinvented, recreated as the Soviet Union, had to deal with. And what we see in this war is it's not just the Russian imperial project that encounters Ukraine and Ukrainian national identity, but it is also crucial for the rethinking and re-understanding of Russian national project per se. Because the war was justified by Putin by this claim that Russians and Ukrainians were one and the same people. This is a very imperial model of thinking about what is Russian nation. And that wasn't just a piece of propaganda. That was something that apparently Putin believed in and continues to believe. And one of the reasons for miscalculations and the reasons why the war went so bad for Russia in terms of really the expectation was that the Ukrainians would welcome Russian troops with flowers. That was based on the idea that Ukrainians were really Russians. And they were really captured by a bunch of nationalists and Nazis and so on and so forth. So Putin comes with the imperial notion of the Russian nation that includes all East Slavs or maybe all Russian speakers. And this war not only strengthens Ukraine's separate identity from Russia, but it certainly clearly sends a signal back to Russia in the form of tens of thousands, maybe over 100,000 body bags, that Ukraine is not Russia, that it's time for Russia to rethink its relations not only toward the empire, but also try to rethink their understanding and their geography of who is Russian and who is not Russian. That the time when that thinking was dominant, the 19th century, the imperial era, it's gone. We are in a new period, in a new time. So it's time for Russia to rethink and reinvent itself.
So you think that Putin and Russia's misreading of history led it to not understand the extent to which Ukrainian national identity was rooted in its history?
Exactly. So it is bad history, it's misreading of history that is a major contributing factor not only to the start of the war, but also to the way how war goes so far. And certainly Ukrainians surprised not only Russians, but surprised probably a good part of the world with their resistance and resilience. This is one more reason to go back to the particular type of history and look back at it and see whether it was misread or not. We scholars working in the field knew right away that, of course, that was very bad history. But we believed or wanted to believe that it was just deliberate misuse of history. But the way how things turned out, it looks like that it was not just abuse and misuse, but it was also misreading of history.
It seems to me unusual that this is a conflict in which history is being used as a weapon almost, and that historians are needed more than ever to help make sense of what's happening. Is that fair to say?
I think it is fair to say that. And That's at least is part of the reason why I decided to write this book. And believe that looking at this war from the historical perspective can tell us certain things that no other maybe profession, no other field can offer. I write in the introduction to my book that after going back and forth on the question of whether this is a good project for a historian, whether we can contribute something, I convinced myself to rephrase Winston Churchill that historians are the worst commentators on the contemporary events except everybody else. So I still believe in that.
You mentioned also there the Russian revolutions of 1917. Are there any aspects of those events that we need to understand to make sense of more recent events?
What we see in 1917 is a beginning of the processes that continue today. Because 1917, it's not just the year of the Russian Revolution, of actually two revolutions, one in February, another in October. It's also one of the years of World War One. And World War One is very much, in terms of its outcome, it's about the disintegration of empires, Austria-Hungarian, Ottoman Empire, Russian Empire. And Russian Empire was saved by the Bolsheviks, who put it back, stitched together with the help of internationalist ideology, and by making concessions to the nationalities, because it was also, the so-called Russian Revolution was not just Russian Revolution, it was a revolution of nations in the Russian Empire. So the Bolsheviks were quite innovative and managed to put it together not only by force, but also by this new policies toward nationalities. And they believed themselves, including Mikhail Gorbachev, that the Soviet Union had solved the nationality question. Only to be surprised in 1991 when the Soviet Union died a death of empire, of any other empire, falling apart along the borders and boundaries that at least originally were drawn on the basis of linguistic and cultural maps. So the story that we see now, and I look at it as one of the wars of the Russian and Soviet succession, war of the disintegration of the empire, the story begins in 1917. And we want to believe, at least we hope, that maybe this is a final chapter in that story, but we really don't know. You look at the fall of the Ottoman Empire, it takes centuries for that to happen. The Yugoslav wars in the 1990s would be difficult to understand without knowing something about the Ottoman Empire and the emergence of the independent Slavic states, creating of the federation, and so on and so forth. The today's Middle East and ISIS would be difficult to understand without understanding the Ottoman history. So the story of the reformatting of the former Ottoman space is still going on. So again, I'm hopeful that this war. Will be a final chapter or one of the final chapters, but knowing the history of other empires and what happens in that post-imperial space, I'm not really rushing to conclude that it is the final chapter.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
These are events with a huge afterlife, a huge century-spanning afterlife. Before we get into the events of 1991, are there any other historical moments between 1917 and the early 1990s that you think we should factor in?
The World War II, you can't get around it if you talk about Europe, Eastern Europe, and Ukraine in particular. So on the per capita basis, Ukraine belongs to the three countries that suffered the biggest losses in World War II, in Europe in particular, and globally as well. So the formation of today's borders of Ukraine, this is very much the result and outcome of World War II. And the story of the Crimea and Crimea being passed from the Russian Federation to Ukraine in 1954 is also directly related to World War II, because during the World War II, the indigenous population of the Crimean Tatars were forcefully resettled to Kazakhstan, to Central Asia. So a lot happened in the region during World War II. And that's another important part of the story. And the next would be the fall of the Soviet Union, disintegration of the USSR in 1991. That is by far, I would say, maybe the most important piece of history that one has to take into account looking at this war. One reason for that is that the Soviet Union fell on the issue of Ukraine. So Ukrainians in December of 1991 voted for their independence in referendum. More than 90% of the population said yes. And the Soviet Union fell apart within 1 week, was dissolved by the leaders of Ukraine, Russia, and Belarus. And the question is, why did it happen? Because the question that Ukrainians answered in the referendum of December 91 was not whether you want the Soviet Union to continue or not. The question was whether you want Ukraine to become independent. But with Ukraine going independent, neither Gorbachev nor Yeltsin believed that there was any sense in continuing for Russia to continue this imperial project in the Soviet garbs without Ukraine, which was the second largest Soviet republic, also was Slavic republic and traditionally Orthodox or East Christian. And Yeltsin initiates the process of the disintegration of the Soviet Union and looking for different forms how to maintain Russia's not just presence, but control over the post-Soviet space. And they create the Commonwealth of Independent States, very much dominated by Russia. And Ukraine, that was formerly one of the co-founders of the organization, never formally joined that organization. Because Ukraine looked at the Commonwealth of Independent States as an instrument for what was known in Kyiv as civilized divorce. So from the very beginning, you have very different expectations from that organization on part of Russia and Ukraine. Russia looks at that as the instrument to maintain control over the post-Soviet space. Ukraine, the second largest republic, doesn't join the organization and looks at it, participates in its activities to a degree that they think that will allow them to negotiate a peaceful exit from the Russia-dominated space. And this is the story of the early 1990s and the story that is very important for understanding of today's war, because in that war, that's where this really different visions, different expectations, they clashed.
One thing that really struck me reading your book, and that I perhaps hadn't realized before, is how pivotal the events of 1993 were in this story. Are there any other aspects of that year that you think we should talk about?
93, it's the year when Boris Yeltsin, the democratically elected president of Russia, and really the hope for democracy in Russia and in the post-Soviet space, makes a decision to use army against the parliament, and the Russian tanks start firing at the Russian parliament. The same building that Yeltsin defended in 1991 against the Soviet tanks and against the hardliners' coup against Gorbachev. A few months after this attack on the parliament, Yeltsin rewrites constitution, making it super presidential in many ways, republic. And given all these opportunities, leverages, instruments to create an authoritarian state into the hands whoever would succeed him. And if Yeltsin was trying to use this super presidential republic and prerogatives that came with that and the power that was really focused in the president's office to deal with the communist revanche or nationalist revanche and somehow try to save in some form Russian democracy, Putin, who came after him, used the very same constitution and the very same rights to put Russia more than ever before on the path for authoritarianism. But that path really starts in 1993 with the tanks firing at the Russian parliament. It is very important for Russia. It is important for understanding of Russian state and Russian's regime. But it's also interesting to note that around the same time, Ukraine resolves the tensions and the constitutional crisis, that tensions between the president and the parliament, really in a very different way, by calling for new presidential elections, which were democratic, eventually producing a constitution with the balance of powers being there, not a perfect one, but still being there. So that's between 93 and 96, that's where the path of Ukraine and Russia, they start to go in different directions. They part their ways, not only in terms of language, culture, history, thinking about independence and not independence, but also in a sense of what sort of government, what is the role of democracy in that society would be. So this adds certainly to the tensions that already existed between Russia and Ukraine over other issues, including territorial issues. But now you add also basically authoritarian state, or the state that becomes authoritarian very fast, and the state that one of the few post-Soviet states that maintains democracy. And of course, the first state in Russia, the second is Ukraine.
And in Ukraine, the path towards democracy seemed to accelerate in the years after that, didn't it?
Exactly. In Ukraine, the elites were trying to emulate Russia for a long period of time, certainly in the 1990s, to do exactly what Yeltsin was trying to do in terms of rewriting constitutions, somehow pressuring the parliament to pass the laws that the presidential administration wanted, having a referendum on the presidential powers. But each time authoritarianism was rising in Ukraine, you would get a popular protest, which became known as Maidan, the Maidan revolutions. The first one is in 2004, the Orange Revolution, and then 2013, 2014, the protest that became known as Euro Revolution, European Revolution, or Revolution of Dignity. And that's what stops really kind of a creeping authoritarianism, authoritarian tendencies in Ukraine. People on the streets, and that never happened in Russia, at least to that degree.
How was this growing path democracy viewed and received in Russia?
The 1990s, again, I don't think that there was much attention paid by Boris Yeltsin, for example, to those developments, because at the end of the day, he was thinking about Russia somewhere down the line as a democratic state. So he was using authoritarian methods, allegedly, in the interests of the democracy that would come one day. But things changed, certainly, with coming to power of Vladimir Putin at the beginning of the 2000s. And he already viewed the Orange Revolution of 2004 as a direct threat to Russia. Ukrainian democracy was a threat to the Russian regime in Kremlin on two levels. The first one is that really integration into the European structures depended on whether the country was democratic or not. If Ukraine is democratic, that means that its chances, and not just chances, but the actual politics allowed it to get closer to Europe, to get integrated into a particular program, and that door was closed for Russia. That was becoming more and more authoritarian. So democracy had this also geopolitical dimension. And other one was that at the time when Russia was becoming more and more authoritarian, Ukraine, where Putin believed there were no Ukrainians, there were other Russians or lesser Russians, was becoming democratic, which was a threat to the legitimacy of the regime in Kremlin. And Ukraine, since 2004, emerges as really, if not promised land, then certainly some form of a model for development for the Russian liberals. And they continued to look at Ukraine with a hope. If Ukrainians can do that, then probably Russians can do that as well. So from that point of view, the success of the Ukrainian democracy presented a bigger threat to the regime in Moscow than NATO, could ever present. The more democracy in Ukraine, the more suspicion toward Kyiv was coming from Moscow, starting with the beginning of this century.
We've talked a lot, obviously, about Putin and his views of history. Is it possible to separate him and his views from those of Russia more widely and Russians more widely?
I think it is possible, but it is difficult, and it was becoming more and more difficult the longer he was staying in power. Because the longer he was staying in power, the more control he was assuming over media, over society as a whole. And at the end of the day, his narrative of history, really, there are clear links and connections with the Russian imperial thinkers and the emigre writers and so on and so forth, was something that was accepted, of course, as a norm by part of the Russian society. But at the end, became a dominant narrative because of the position of the person who produced this narrative. The society, certainly the professional historians, didn't think that way. A big part of the elite didn't think that way. But at the end, it was Putin's vision that became the vision of the state and of the state propaganda.
There are two geographical regions that have obviously been in the headlines a lot since 2014, and they're Crimea and the Donbass. Could you talk through to listeners, I suppose, who may have heard those names but not be entirely familiar as to why they're so important historically, what led to those becoming particularly important regions, I suppose?
Crimea is the only region in Ukraine where Ukrainians didn't and don't constitute the majority, ethnic Ukrainians, I mean. The majority are ethnic Russians. And the Crimea was part of the Russian Federation before World War II, and then was transferred to Ukraine in the aftermath of World War II. And the main reason for that was really geography, because Crimea is a peninsula and Ukraine happens to be the mainland. And Crimea, as being part of the Russian Federation, was lagging behind in terms of the post-war reconstruction, economic development, and so on and so forth, for administrative reasons, logistical reasons, and so on and so forth. So the Soviet government in the mid-1950s decided that we should actually make peninsula closer to the mainland and administratively and economically and otherwise, and that should work. And it worked on all those levels. But then, with the fall of the Soviet Union, what we see is that the fact that Russians were the majority in Crimea, that led to the changes in the Ukrainian constitution, where the Crimea as a region was elevated to the level of the autonomous republic. So some autonomy was given to the Crimea. But Crimea was considered to be, by Putin, but not only by Putin, I would say, but by many people in Kremlin, in the Russian administration, to be really a Russian land that was lost by mistake to Ukraine. Crimea had a big symbolic importance in Russian culture, imperial culture. That was the location of the holy places of the Crimean War of the mid-19th century, which was an imperial war. And the holy places were conceptualized, thought about in terms of Russian imperial nationalism, plus Russian ethnic majority. The Russian movement in the Crimea or anywhere in Ukraine was never strong enough to put on the agenda the question of really separation. But there was enough tension between Crimea and Kyiv that when the military takeover of the Crimea started in 2014, and that's February of 2014, that's really the beginning of this war, current war, there was enough people that the Russian security services, intelligence services could mobilize. The Sevastopol remained to be the base of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, So Russians had really a sort of extraterritoriality there on the territory of Sevastopol. The troops that moved and then took over Crimea overall in 2014 were certainly coming from Sevastopol. So Crimea always had a history that was maybe somewhat separate from the history of Ukraine. But it never had the Russian-Ukrainian tensions, either in Crimea or anywhere else, never reached the stage where they wouldn't be or couldn't be managed by the government in Kyiv. But that was something that was enough for Putin to use as an instrument in his war on Ukraine. The closest parallel would be many were talking about annexation of the Crimea in 2014, drawing parallels with Anschluss, takeover of Austria by Nazi Germany in 1938, or the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia in 1939. And then, of course, Hitler would go after entire Czechoslovakia. So the closest parallel would be with the Nazi Germany and the attempt to take over the German-speaking or ethnic German territories and then using that as a platform for further aggression. So the parallels are very, very close.
I wanted to talk to you about historical parallels such as that, because, so for instance, in April, the German president drew parallels between the Nazi quashing of the 1943 Warsaw Ghetto uprising and the invasion of Ukraine. Do you think such historical comparisons are useful, or are they fraught in some senses with danger as well?
Well, on the one hand, there is a particular a taboo, really, on comparing either Hitler to any of the current sitting leaders or comparing Nazi Germany either to Russia or to any other country. And I certainly understand where it is coming from. But as a historian, I also should say that we historians, we can't just ignore the parallels, historical parallels in particular. We have to be dispassionate. Of course, it's important not to politicize history. But on the other hand, there are so many parallels between the project of Greater Germany and now the project of Greater Russia. So ignoring that would be really irresponsible and to a certain degree betraying the principles of our profession. So I'm okay probably with not exactly okay, but I can understand taboos when it comes to the public discourse. But I think that when it comes to the academic discourse and our research, those taboos should not be there, because then we have blind spots and we miss very important things in history. And that means that we... As historians, we have much less ability to help our contemporaries to understand not just history, but also what is happening today.
We've talked a bit about these events being part of a wider narrative sweep. Do you think that the current conflict has the potential to shift the global axis of power? Do you think these are events that have major international repercussions?
I'm absolutely convinced that this war has and will continue to have a major impact on the global developments. And this war is compared quite often now, and for very good reason, to World War II. This is the largest war in Europe since World War II in terms of the number of soldiers, number of guns, shells, the level of destruction, the sort of atrocities that are being committed, and so on and so forth. So it's not exactly World War II, but the fact that it's the biggest since World War II tells you that this is a big event. And it's only natural to expect that the event of such proportions would impact not just Russia and not just Ukraine. And indeed, this is what already is happening, and probably that the trend will continue. One thing is very clear, that Russia will emerge out of that war weakened, significantly weakened compared to the way how it was on February 24th, 2022, militarily. They bragged that they were the second strongest army in the world. And Ukrainian joke now goes that they turned out to be the second strongest army in Ukraine. That is important clarification, I would say. Economically, it's the same. So we are dealing, at least for some period of time, it will continue a sort of an implosion of Russia. We also see today the strengthening of the transatlantic alliance. strengthening of NATO, expansion of NATO. Sweden is joining NATO, changing its policy of neutrality that was there for 200 years or more than 200 years. Well, this is a historic event. And again, it is directly related to this war. What you see is also Russia reorienting itself in many ways from Europe toward China and toward the East. And this is also a historic development that the beginning of the current policy that are being changed are not even at the end of the Cold War, but it's the early 1970s detente when the Soviet Union starts exporting oil and gas to Europe, to Central Europe in particular. So now you see all these things, the reverse. It goes now toward the East, not toward Europe. And I expect all these things that I talked about, when we see them already happening, I expect them to continue just because of the impact of the war itself, but also because there are other processes that really support the developments that I just discussed. The concern about the fossil fuels and climate change certainly contributing to the trend of divesting Europe from Russian oil and gas, and the war accelerated that. So war accelerates certain processes that were already taking place, happening, and the impact of the war is global, not just European.
And just as much as this is a story about the Russian attack, it's one about the Ukrainian fight back. Do you think, because of the historical things we've talked about, this conflict will leave Ukrainian people with a stronger sense of national identity?
Yes, I have no doubt in that regard. The war started to change Ukraine already in 2014. The processes of the consolidation of the nation, stronger national identity, they started in 2014. And one of the mistakes of Putin was that, on a certain level, believed that in 2022 he was invading Ukraine of 2014. The expectation would be that it would be another Crimea, or maybe something a little bit more difficult, but roughly there. So all these dramatic changes that happened in Ukraine between 2014 and 2022 were pretty much missed. And those changes were about the consolidation of the nation. The political map of Ukraine was changed. If before that, presidential elections were divided in Ukraine half and half, and then there would be pendulum going back and forth. The winner would get 52% and the loser would get 47% or something like that. What you look at the presidential elections after 2014, either election of President Poroshenko in 2014 or then later President Zelensky, it's a landslide, at least when you look at the map. They're carrying 90% of the precincts, which also tells me about the sense of unity and coherence in the nation that didn't exist before. The issue of whether Ukraine should orient itself toward Russia and the West was resolved with the Russian takeover of the Crimea. The nation became clearly very much pro-European. The goal of joining NATO was inscribed in Ukrainian constitution after that. And all of these changes really became clear and obvious in February and March of 2022. At no point in this war, any poll ever showed that there would be less than 75% of the Ukrainians that believed in victory. Even in early March of 2022, when it wasn't clear whether Kyiv would survive or not, what would happen, how far the Russian troops would go, the majority of population believed in victory. And now, of course, those numbers went up. Modern nations are being imagined by historians and philosophers and political thinkers. They're being mapped with the help of linguists and ethnologists who collect folklore. But they come into existence, unfortunately, very often as the result of wars and major conflicts. There was a big hope back in 1991 that we were able to get around that one of the biggest empires or post-imperial states fell apart without a major war. A sort of a miracle happened. My colleague Stephen Kotkin wrote a book, Armageddon Averted, the expectation was that the Cold War could end really in some form of nuclear Armageddon. And what we see now is that, unfortunately, this long durée process of disintegration of the Russian Empire still continues. So it's sad to acknowledge that, but that's what we learned from this war. One of the things that we learned from it.
That was Serhii Plokhii. His latest book, The Russo-Ukraine War, is out now, published by Allen Lane. Serhii has previously appeared on the podcast to discuss the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. If you're interested in hearing that, just search for Chernobyl in your podcast feeds. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Sam Leal Green.